Hello, welcome to 8.9 Newsweek. I'm Finn Locustain. Our Newsweek podcast brings together a collection of the audio from the recent 8.9 video interviews. If you want to watch instead of listen, then please visit our website at 8.9.com and click on the TV tab. So we've got five conversations for you today on topics ranging from the constant struggle for tenant farmers to the dangers of slurry pollution. First of all, we've got Martin Lines from the Nature Friendly Farming Network discussing the NFFN's general election manifesto. And then Peter Powell from the Welsh D Trust telling us about the terrible impact that slurry can have on rivers. And then it's Vicky van der Stickel from North Star Transition who'll tell me that scale is critical when it comes to financing nature-based solutions, followed by George Dunn, the Chief Executive of the Tenant Farmers Association, who tell me about the often poor relationship between tenant farmers and their landlords. And as if that wasn't enough, we'll finish with Robin Walter from the Soil Association, who'll come and make the case for regenerative forestry. Well, it's a bumper crop of conversation, so let's get cracking. The Nature Friendly Farming Network has unveiled its manifesto ahead of the upcoming UK general election. The farmers' organisation is calling, amongst other things, for a fit-for-purpose agricultural budget. I spoke to Chief Executive Martin Lines and I asked him what that means.
Well, if we look at the current budget, it's been set for a long period of time, and with inflation and cost of delivering, isn't significant enough to deliver the ambition of this government and the next government. If we look at the seriousness of halting and the cost of halting nature's decline, managing and mitigating for climate, and supporting farmers in having infrastructure that delivers food security for now and for the future, a significant increase in budget is needed. And that really needs to be delivered right across the UK to meet the government's ambitions around nature and climate.
Now, you're talking about £6 billion within your manifesto, which is around double the current budget. What would farmers have to do to earn this extra money?
I think a lot of what they've already been doing, but a lot of it would be like new hedgerows, managing trees, increasing tree planting, managing waterways, slowing flow of water down, natural flood management, increasing pollinating areas and areas for birdseed mixes. All of this extra natural capital or environmental features have a cost to farmers to implement. If I increase the number of miles of hedgerows I have, my cost of management goes up. And we're, the real need of this budget is to support farmers in delivering them environmental improvements across our farm landscape, which are a public good, and they don't get rewarded from the marketplace for food production. So it's around, really delivering a nature-friendly farming landscape at a landscape approach in really delivering for the targets that society has in halting nature's decline, in improving and supporting food production in a healthier, productive landscape, and mitigating against climate change.
Now, last year, a report for the RSPB, the National Trust and the Wildlife Trusts called for a budget increase to at least £4.4 billion. You're talking about £6 billion. Is there a firm basis for that number?
No, there's a lot of basis to it, and a lot of the organisations like Link, the environment groups, and this is a UK budget. There is evidence behind what is needed to deliver on the government's targets, what is needed to support long-term food production in focusing on soil health and systems approach. So there is all evidence behind that. It's not just a figure picked out of the air, because as a farmer, let's double it again, because that would be a benefit. We need to understand the costs of managing the environment for farmers, and farmers manage 70% of the landscape. So there's a real opportunity to really encourage farmers to deliver at scale and at pace that will deliver not just for farmers, but also for society. And the society can help contribute towards that.
At a time of economic crunch, when every government department wants more money from the Treasury, have you spoken to political parties? What do they think of this proposal?
We have spoken to many of all the political parties. We're going to have to show value for money. The Treasury has many calls on it, and farming is only, and the environment is one. But as farmers, we can really demonstrate the value for money. For the pound that you put into farmers, they're delivering £3 to £7 benefit to society. So it's really good cost savings, particularly when we look across government departments around health and environment and climate. Farmers can deliver right across that broad spectrum. The focus is in the DEFRA pot, but actually the value should be spread across government departments, because we can deliver for many outcomes society needs and government needs to pay for.
So you think that it's not just DEFRA that should be contributing, but, for example, Department of Health?
Yeah, very much so. Matt, I had it put to me the other day that, the Department of Health is the Department of Sick. The Department of the Environment is the Department of Health. We need to refocus around how do we manage our landscape to deliver cleaner air, cleaner water, natural access to nature, which improves mental health, so we can cut the mental health bill. We really need to look at the budget agriculture or DEFRA gets in a bigger context of delivering for society.
So we've talked about an increased farming budget, a carrot if you like, but does there also need to be a stick? Do we need better enforced regulation too?
Yeah, I think it's only fair that if we've been incentivizing farmers and land managers to do good stuff, we also need to be focusing on how do we stop bad stuff happening. And we already know that much of the regulation isn't really enforced particularly greatly. There's not the resources and the budget to do that. And as a farmer, I find it very disappointing sometimes that if I'm trying to do the right things and be rewarded for those, I can look in my landscape and see people not doing the right things but getting away with it. So why would I want to incur inconvenience to do other things? So there needs to be a carrot and stick. And I'm always a proposal and talking when we talk to governments and that of a three strike rule. The first time should be an engagement to help you see where there may be some funding, how you should stop for those minor infringements. But if you're a repeat offender, I'm sorry, you should go, almost straight to jail, not literally, but that fine should come in to really make you change and improve your system. We just need a fairer baseline that everyone works to that is regulated and enforced, and you can't get away with causing pollution or risk.
And of course, those that are operating below those regulatory standards are putting farmers like yourself at a competitive disadvantage as well. Now, you suggested there that farmers should be prosecuted. This is something that doesn't happen very often in Britain. Do you really think that more farmers need to be taken to court if they fail to meet basic standards?
Farming is no different than any other industry. If our activity is causing pollution and we are knowingly and willingly doing it, there has to be a penalty. There's a society penalty for any industry, and farming should be no different. But we recognise that many farms are going to need some help and support to, one, recognise they may be causing problems if they're unaware, which we have to take that on a case by case, but also a road to improvement. And that might mean significant investment. That might mean significant changes. And we just need some time for many businesses to understand the rules, support in a change in direction, and have time to deliver those improvements.
The manifesto also talks about the need for a fair and transparent supply chain. What needs to change?
If we look at our current supply chain, there's little value actually coming onto farms. There's lots of value within the supply chain. And a lot of practices that are disadvantaging farmers and hiding the unintended consequences, that encouraging farmers to harvest crops in the winter when it's really poor soil quality to meet a contract and a specification, is causing harm. And we need some of that cost of production in contracts that cause harm on a landscape to be fairly rewarded and not just picked up by the farmer, but also the fair cost of production. We know many contracts are not in fair cost of production, and we're importing produce at a lower standard that we're enforcing in the UK.
You seem to be suggesting there that we need to return to a greater level of seasonality. Is that right?
Very much so. We know nature gives us abundance at different times of the year, and that's when the 2-for-1 offers or any promotion should be matches in when there's an abundance of crop. And we need to understand that having a food available of all year round has a cost to our environment. Having strawberries 12 months of the year, having certain vegetables available, that means they come from other places. And if we can produce a lot more fruit and vegetables in the UK, but only at certain times of year, and that should be the abundance time when we eat it, but also process it, and we put it in cans and in freezers for later in the season.
Now, you've talked about the need to be able to sell at least above the costs of production, which is something that farmers have said they've needed for a long time. How do we actually achieve that?
I think we need some transparency in what costs are and what contractors are, the contracts to suppliers, and then sort of open it up to have an honest where are we, and sort of get people to understand that if the suppliers do not support and give farmers enough money to invest in the system, they will come out of production. Farmers are becoming very increasingly affected by climate, by cost of production, and choosing to say it's too high a risk, there's not enough margin. that will really sort of undermine food supply and those industries in the future, because what I stop producing today means there'll be an effect next year because that crop won't be there to be harvested. And we seem to have a supply chain focus on very short-term contracts, short-term delivery, and we need a length of contracts and transparency in who's making the margins.
You mentioned climate there, Martin, and just finally, I want to address ecological security. How do national and international supply chains need to change to prepare society for an accelerating level of climate breakdown?
I think they need to take some ownership of their supply chain and understand the impact that is having. We are already seeing many of the major supply chains actually investing in farmers to move to more regenerative systems and supporting practices that are heading in those directions. And I think any future corporation that doesn't focus on its supply chain and its resilience to climate change will have major problems in putting products on shelves. So it is the only way those companies will have food available to sell. And that means working with farmers, but also not just in the UK. It's going to be globally, because we may get a global weather event in the UK that undermines our production, and we will need to import produce from other places. But the flip will happen on another year, that we will have an abundance, and that means we have some exportable surplus. And we need to be working at a more global level to deliver that long-term food security.
The UK is currently around 60% self-sufficient. Do you think that we need to have a national target to increase that level of self-sufficiency to, for example, 70 or 80 or even 90%?
I think if we look at the self-sufficiency figure, it's skewed, because it doesn't, a lot of the citrus fruits, there's lots of stuff we are choosing to eat that we cannot produce. So we're never going to be self-sufficient in it. But we should really focus on those items that we could be self-sufficient in, which, fruits, vegetables, apples, pears, stuff that we are importing huge quantities of that we could be producing. So we need to look at the matrix and the measure to make sure we're accounting for the right stuff. And we really should be focusing on those areas we are good at, and we have a climate that can produce that product, not just the cost of production, that it's cheaper currently to import, but it won't be in the future when they have a drought or have a weather impact.
That was Martin Lines from the Nature Friendly Farming Network. Peter Powell, Chief Executive of the Welsh D Trust, recently drew attention to slurry pollution incidents in North Wales, each of which he says would have been devastating to the wildlife living in rivers. Peter joined me for a conversation, and I started by asking him just how much of a problem slurry pollution really is.
So, slurry this year in particular has become a really severe pollution problem for rivers, particularly here in Wales, where we have a lot of rainfall. In the last couple of weeks, there's been three quite serious slurry pollution incidents in Wales that have been pretty devastating for the river. And it is one of the more severe pollutants that is finding itself into watercourses. One of the big issues of slurry is that it's actually much more toxic than a lot of other things. Say sewage, which is also finding its way, thousands of litres of sewage are finding their way into rivers, but that's actually quite made up mostly of sort of tap water and drinking water, whereas slurry is really quite concentrated animal excreta. And because it's so concentrated, that means when a litre of it is much more toxic when it finds its way into the river. So that's quite a severe problem, really, when that happens.
Now, farmers might reasonably assume that rainwater will dilute the slurry before it hits watercourses, in just the same way that the sewage system dilutes human waste. Is there a diluting effect?
Yeah, I mean, there is almost definitely a diluting effect. The more rainfall mixed in with the slurry, the more it's diluted. But there's a couple of different pathways that slurry is making its way into watercourses. There's the spreading and the overland flows and the rainfall diluting it that way. Also, one of the other ones that we find quite a severe one is slurry making its way into clean water drains within the farmyards. So that's almost pure slurry there, not diluted at all, getting into a clean water drain, going through the drain and into the river that way. Those slurry pollution incidents I was talking about, they were more where issues had appeared in the farmyard, and slurry had escaped the farmyard rather than the other pathway, which is, spreading across fields.
When you say that there were serious incidents, how do you define serious?
I mean, a really serious incident is when you have a fish kill and you have dead fish appearing within a river. But I think any level of slurry pollution within a river is going to be causing some damage to invertebrates or to the wildlife, and make it much more difficult environment and upset the river ecosystem. So even small levels will affect it, but more serious ones where you're getting a fish kill, or the river is discolored, smells of slurry, looks more like slurry than it does a clean water, really.
Now, the weather this winter has been so awful that it can't be a surprise that slurry tanks are overflowing. Other than spread, what can farmers do right now?
I mean, this it's coming to a head at the moment because we have had such a long period of wet weather that even the best systems of all the correct infrastructure in place are really starting to be stretched and suffer. We need to be investing in storage so that we can store it for as long as possible. But it is a really challenging year, and I think that's why we're seeing quite so many slurry incidents at the moment.
But in terms of dealing with it at this stage, if farmers are in the situation where the slurry tanks are overflowing, is it not better to spread the muck over a wider field area than to just allow it to leach in a more concentrated form from the farmyard?
Yes, and I mean the best thing would be to get out, spread it on fields. Try and get. It doesn't feel like we've had any windows of nice weather, but if there's one short afternoon of nice weather, and get it out and get it spread rather than letting the slurry overflow or get into a clean water drain. That would be the best in an emergency situation. It may be worth talking to NRW or the Environment Agency or another government organisation if you really are up against it, and pre-warning them that you're taking what would be essentially be emergency measures to avoid a slow lagoon failure. But really, we should be investing in the infrastructure and the storage so that we're not finding ourselves in these situations.
Well, looking to the future and the likelihood of more long wet winters as a result of climate change, what are the solutions?
I mean, there's a few. One is investing in farmyard infrastructure, and to do that, farms need to be able to get paid enough money for the produce they're producing so that they can invest in the future. So that's better clean water, dirty water separation, slightly larger slurry lagoons, better organized yards so that the slurry is easier to manage. But I think also, if we are going to continue to have really, really unpredictable and very wet weather like we're having, we should be taking steps to try and reduce the amount of time that cattle are spending indoors, try and get them outdoors more. That means looking at changing grazing practices, trying to improve soil health as much as possible so that the fields are then more resilient to this wet weather. You can keep the livestock out for longer. If they're not in the farmyards, they're not producing as much slurry. You don't need as much storage, and that sort of makes the whole system slightly easier to manage during extreme weather. Obviously, this year we've had so much rain. There's a limit to how much you can do, but I think we should be really taking steps to try and reduce. Improve the, I guess, the water holding capability of the land and making our farms more resilient to wet weather and extreme weather.
Now, Peter, you're based in Wales and the sustainable farming scheme has yet to come in. And of course, that's going to prioritise soil health and more nature-based solutions. But are there currently grants available for upgrading slurry infrastructure?
There's been a few from Welsh Government, but I think it's everyone that's came out has been massively oversubscribed, and it's a real need for support out there to help farmyards help farms improve their farmyards, improve their slurry infrastructure. I think it needs to be coming from Welsh Government. I think it needs to be coming from milk buyers, but I think ultimately the whole food system needs to be set up so that farms, are making enough money from the produce they're selling to be able to invest in the business. But I think we're now in a situation where so much investment is needed that somewhat governments or milk buyers need to step in to help upgrade due to the severe lack of investment over the last sort of decade or 2 decades or so on a lot of farms.
Now, you've got a webinar coming up on Thursday, the 11th of April, which is focused particularly on phosphorus pollution. What are you going to be covering?
Yeah, so this phosphorus is one of the sort of nutrients that you find in slurry, but also in sewage, and it's having quite a big impact on the River Dee. The River Dee is a special area of conservation, and so because of that, it's got targets for all sorts of nutrients and pollutants, including phosphorus, and it's failing currently. And some of its water bodies are failing for phosphorus targets. This is having quite a big impact on development, and quite a lot of local development has stopped can't get planning permission because of the phosphorus levels. So in that webinar, I'm going to sort of talk about all the various different pathways that phosphorus is making its way into the river, and the work that Welsh Deer Trust is doing to sort of disconnect some of those pathways, try and reduce the amount of phosphorus, and then look to the future about how we can, ultimately reduce the phosphorus in the river, unlock developments, and help improve the river ecosystem and bring it back within the targets of the Special Area of Conservation.
Peter Powell from the Welsh Dee Trust. A report by North Star Transition says that there is an urgent need for large-scale funding of nature-based solutions across many landscapes if the UK is to achieve net zero, environmental, social and health transformations. Vicky van der Stickel worked on the report. I asked her where large-scale funding for nature-based solutions should come from.
At North Star Transition, we want to see landscape transform from degenerative to regenerative in all its aspects, from farming to transport and healthcare. And we want to create deep systemic change. And nature-based solutions are an aspect of this transformation. And we understand nature-based solutions very broadly to include natural flood defences, regenerative agriculture, and so for a very broad base. And we, as you suggested, we have a deficit in funding for nature-based solutions required to pull us out of the multiple crises we are facing. So we desperately need to increase our investment in nature-based solutions. And so we need funding from a lot of different quarters, from both public and private. And the private money includes philanthropic or charity investment, but also financial institutions such as banks and pension funds and insurers.
Should government and taxpayers and the private sector be paying for different things?
So yeah, that's a really interesting and relevant question. And from the financial institutions perspective, which is what we are trying to look at North Star Transition, they have a very sort of specific thing that they want to invest in, and they want to invest in things that produce the right level of return for them. Financial institutions have what's called fiduciary duties, which means that they have to have a certain level of return for their stakeholders, and they won't invest in things which don't provide that return. And this is historically where the government and philanthropic funding has stepped in to invest in those things which are essentially for financial institutions uninvestable. However, for North Star Transition, this poses a problem because we want to create interventions in the landscape on a broad scale, which really will transform the landscape. And if we have financial institutions which are hesitating to invest in certain interventions which are necessary, then in our view, the project will not provide the regeneration which is required. So this is where our report comes in, where we want to actually aggregate all these interventions together, so which means that financial institutions aren't able to cherry pick only the investments which they believe will provide a return. This is also where blended finance comes in. So the government, the public, and the public sector coming together with the private sector to invest in all the interventions necessary for a regenerative change to the landscape.
Since the work of Dieter Helm and the Natural Capital Committee, there's been a relative consensus over what defines public or private goods. This agreement seems to have become more strained recently, with food production now being thought of much more frequently as both a public and a private good. How do you deal with that?
Yeah, so that's a very interesting question. And we at North Star Transition are really focused on what stakeholders want in the landscape. And food production is something which people feel very close to, and it's an extremely important part of everyone's life. So the extent to which we can keep stakeholder ownership over food production, we want to encourage that. We do not want to see a situation where that is taken out of the power to create food is taken out of people's hands.
In the North Star report, you say that investment tends to be project-based rather than place-based. What's the difference and how can change happen?
Yeah, so yeah, let me first explain what we mean by project-based and place-based. What we mean by project-based is investments that are quite discrete and piecemeal. So this actually happens quite a lot in the UK at the moment. You'll see everywhere that nature-based solutions are happening. But the problem that North Star Transition has with these nature-based solutions is that they're great in principle, but they are often very limited in the impacts that they have. Because what we really need to have is a broader look at what's going on and transformation at scale. So not just simple, limited, project-based solutions, but place-based solutions. And what we mean by that is projects that operate to transform an entire landscape. On the one hand, large-scale place-based investments are much more attractive to institutional investors because a project-based nature-based solution will probably be a ticket size of maybe £1 million, £2 million, which just isn't attractive to institutional investors who are used to, you know, projects of £1 billion in size. So as a minimum, they probably want to invest about £200 million in something. So this means that a place-based approach is more attractive in one way. But the flip side of that is that the setup costs for that place-based intervention is much higher. The risks are multiplied manyfold. And the time it takes to actually put together all these interventions to create a plan is very high. So it takes a lot of time to put this together, which makes it, less attractive for investors. So it's sort of the balance of these two things makes it easier on the one hand, but also harder on the other. And that is the issue that North Star Transition is tackling at the moment.
In your research dialogues, what did investors identify as the chief risks to nature-based investment?
So yeah, we would see the chief risks as threefold. The first is construction operational risks. The second is regulatory risks. And the third is reputational risks. So construction and operational risks are those involved with creating the project and then running the project. It's sometimes very difficult to foresee what those costs will be in creating the project and running the project. And if as those costs increase, then the revenue for the financial institution decreases. So any impact on those initial costs will end up impacting the viability of the project. Then the second issue is the regulatory risks. At the moment, we have a lot of moving parts in the regulatory landscape, and things are really at the developmental stage. And a project which might last 10, 20, 30 years, it's really difficult for financial institutions to know what the regulatory landscape will be in 20 years' time and whether their project is still something which is accepted by the regulatory landscape. And then the third issue, the reputational risk, is, financial institutions are very concerned about their reputation and getting involved in a project which might not end up being as successful as they'd hoped could really impact their reputation. For example, we've seen recently a lot of companies who have done carbon sequestration have run across issues with that and have overpromised the amount of carbon they're sequestering. And that kind of reputation impact is massive, and financial institutions are really wary of getting involved with projects that could impact them in that area.
It seems as though reputational risk will reduce through experience and improved science, and that the operational risks could come down as implementation knowledge is acquired and solutions better understood. The regulatory risk seems like the biggest challenge, because knowing how governments are going to legislate and regulate globally and nationally in such an important and emerging area, and the impacts that this might have at a farm landscape or investor level, that's difficult over a five-year period, let alone a 30-year period.
Yes, the regulatory risk is a challenge. We hear that again and again from people saying, we need regulation from the government to help us do this. We need to know what the parameters are and what the, you know, how the government will see this. But the issue is with regulation is that it usually follows after the fact, and it's very slow to actually bring regulation to the table. I mean, it could take 5 years or something for the government to enact a bill to solve these kind of issues. So from our perspective, from North Star Transition's perspective, the interventions need to happen now, and we need to work with what we have, and the regulatory landscape will follow.
Looking forward, what are the key barriers as you see it in terms of what the market needs to resolve?
So as you may as I've hinted at throughout this whole interview, there are a huge range of issues which are barriers to unlocking finance for nature-based solutions. But the key one for North Star Transition is that the system is currently just not set up to recognise and support nature-based solutions at scale. So just to give an example, if a government agency wants to build flood defences in the form of grey infrastructure, they know exactly how to go about doing that. There's a whole host of economic actors who are prepared to help them do that. There are banks who can fund the creation of this. They've done this multiple times before. They know exactly what they need to do for that. There are engineering firms who have specifications for these for this grey infrastructure. There are insurance companies who are happy to insure if the flood defences can hold up or not. And then if something goes wrong with the flood defences, the government can sue someone for that wrong and perhaps get some of its money back. But in contrast to the whole ecosystem which has been created around grey infrastructure, for nature-based solutions, that just doesn't exist. Nature-based solutions only raise questions. So, you know, what are the specifications for nature-based solutions? There's nothing that's been agreed, by regulatory bodies. And who is going to build the nature-based solution? Again, there's a limited visibility of that. How will it be funded? I mean, that's what we at North Star Transition are looking at. And it's still such a grey area. And how will the insurance operate for these nature-based solutions? Insurance companies just don't have experience with insuring nature-based solutions. And then what are the co-benefits of that? And how can we harness those co-benefits? Again, these things are all questions which perhaps have some answers, but it's still very nascent and we're still working through all those. And then, so if a government agency is faced with choosing between a nascent area where there are more questions than answers or something which they're very used to doing, then it's the dial is always shift towards grey infrastructure rather than nature-based solutions. So trying to change that systemic approach is fundamental to bringing more financing for nature-based solutions.
It seems as though the financial sector is going to have to devise a wholly different approach to specifying investments in nature-based solutions, because nature simply doesn't behave consistently in the way that bricks and concrete do.
Yeah, I would say that we see the system as being an issue at North Star Transition, and that there needs to be a wholesale different approach. Where that will come from and how that will manifest is yet to be seen. I mean, we're hoping that increasing technology, increasing interest in this area will reduce the risks for financial institutions and everyone getting involved with nature-based solutions. But we agree that there needs to be a different approach, and whether that will come from financial institutions or be pushed on them by governments is yet to be seen.
That was Vicky van der Stickel from North Star Transition. In the recent UK budget, the Chancellor chose not to make the changes to inheritance tax that the Tenant Farmers Association have been calling for and which they believed would encourage longer-term farm tenancies. George Dunn is the Chief Executive of the Tenant Farmers Association, and I asked him what changes he'd been seeking and why.
Yeah, so we were looking for changes that would encourage landlords to let tenancies for longer periods of time. So at the moment, on farm tenancies, we have an average length of term of just over 3 years. And we have 80% of all new tenancies let for 5 years or less. Now, for us, those lengths of term are really not good enough to build sensible, viable, long-term businesses. And neither are they good enough to meet some of the environmental challenges that we are now being asked to deliver in terms of carbon, biodiversity, landscape, etc. So we suggested that the landlord's opportunity to gain what's called agricultural property relief, which is a relief that landlords get from inheritance tax on the full agricultural value of land, that should be only available to landlords who were prepared to let for periods of 10 years or more. So that people who were letting for less than 10 years didn't get the tax advantage, because it is a significant benefit to the landlord community. And we would argue, well, what does the nation get back if those landlords are only prepared to let for very short periods of time? So if we're trying to encourage landlords to let longer, then the setting the bar at 10 years to us seemed a sensible thing to do, so that only those who are letting over that period of time would get the benefit of the tax incentive.
Clearly, you've been talking to government about this. Had you been expecting the Chancellor to move ahead with these changes?
So this decision was part of a consultation exercise that was launched by the Treasury the previous budget in the spring 2023 budget. And that consultation stemmed from a report that was prepared by Baroness Kate Rock into the Tenanted Sector of Agriculture, which took forward our idea for restricting APR, agricultural property relief. Baroness Rock set the bar at 8 years. We obviously set the bar at 10 years, but 8 years was where Baroness Kate Rock set the limit. So this has been in discussion with government for a very long period of time, and I had conversations with the previous financial secretary to the Treasury, Victoria Atkins, but she was then moved to be health secretary. in the last reshuffle of the Prime Minister. And unfortunately, the new incumbent in the role, Nigel Huddleston, refused to meet with the TFA to discuss the policy. And at that point, we realised that we might be facing a bit of a problem come the budget, and certainly we did.
Do you have any sense of why the government chose not to move ahead with the changes to inheritance tax?
I think in the consultation, there was a... I would say there was a coalition of voices who have a vested interest in allowing the status quo to continue in terms of the way in which land is let, to have the maximum flexibility in the way in which land is let in this country. And they didn't want any change. They didn't want to have any further restrictions applied to the marketplace. Our view was that there was a market failure here because we need longer term tenancies. But that coalition of bodies, I think, put the fear of God into the Treasury, if you like, and they decided it was probably too risky to make a move at this stage.
Well, let's move on to some of the impacts in terms of the length of tenancies. Now, you touched on one or two earlier, but what impact do short tenancies have on tenant farming businesses?
So obviously, agriculture is a very long-term game. You know, you have to... match the profitable years with the unprofitable years. We've seen over the past few years, we've gone from drought to flood and back again. And here we are in another period of flood, and you need to have that long-term ability to play one year against another. But also, if you're looking to invest in fixed equipment on land, you need to borrow money to do that. And those bodies who will be lending you money will want to know that you've got sufficient security to repay that debt over a sensible period of time. And if you lack that security as a tenant farmer, you may not get the borrowing that you need to invest in the new technology and the fixed equipment to take your business forward. But in addition, as I said earlier, in terms of the environmental outputs, if we're looking at soil management, if we're looking at carbon sequestration for climate change benefits, if we're looking at landscape change, we're looking at enhancing biodiversity, those things take a very long period of time to come to fruition. And even the government schemes that are available sometimes ask for quite long terms in order to ensure that the public money is getting the public goods that are being paid for. So there's a number of reasons why longer-term tenancies are really, really needed.
Now, from what you're saying, it's already more difficult for tenant farmers to make a living out of the land. But do shorter-term tenancies mean that it's also more difficult for tenant farmers to access payments under the SFI, which is replacing basic acreage-based payments?
Yeah, so the SFI, or the Sustainable Farming Incentive, has been a particular focus of work for us with DEFRA over the past few years to ensure that our members, many of whom have those short-term agreements, have access to those schemes. And it has taken a little while, but DEFRA has understood the need to design those schemes in a way which provide an opportunity for tenants to take part. So we have been working very closely to make sure that even some of the shortest-term agreements are able to get into to SFI. They won't be able to get into all of the SFI options, so some of the options will be barred because they require longer terms. But DEFRA has at least recognized that their schemes need to reflect what's happening in the market, even if we don't get longer tenancies. The areas where we are still struggling are on some of the deeper environmental schemes, so things like countryside stewardship or landscape recovery or even tree planting schemes, which are unavailable to tenant farmers. So those are the areas where we still have a lot of work to do to ensure that tenants have access.
And correct me if I'm wrong, George, but around a third of the farmers in Britain are tenant farmers, aren't they? So if they're unable to access these payments, then that's quite a big hole in terms of delivery of the government's nature ambitions.
Yeah, so it's about a third of the land is under some form of tenancy. There's probably, 60, 70% of individuals who would technically be tenant farmers because they are renting some land. But in terms of those individuals who are either wholly or predominantly reliant upon tenanted land for their businesses, we're probably talking between 20 to 25% of individuals in that category. And yeah, you're right. You know, the schemes need to work for all types of land occupation, owner occupiers, tenants, people with common grazing rights. And so, and sometimes policymakers have this idea when they're developing policies that every farmer is an owner-occupier, that they own the land that they're farming and they can internalize the decisions that they need to make about responding to government schemes and government initiatives. It's often forgotten that there are people like tenant farmers or people who are farming with common land or under grazing licenses. And yeah, if we don't have solutions for those individuals, a significant amount of land will be unable to access the new schemes.
Now, as if to add insult to injury, the Tenant Farmers Association also recently released the results of a survey that showed really very poor relationships between many farm tenants and their landlords. What can be done to improve these relationships?
Yeah, it was really gut-wrenching to read some of the comments that we had back from our members. You know, I've been chief executive of the TFA for 27 years, and to hear and to read stories of people who felt bullied and harassed by their landlords and their landlords' agents was, you know, made me think, well, what have I been doing for the past 27 years if this is still the narrative that people are coming up with? But I think now there's a real recognition of the need to change the environment within which those relationships operate. We are on the cusp, you'd be pleased to hear, of having a published code of practice or conduct in landlord-tenant relationships that we believe will be signed up to by the organizations representing tenants, the organizations representing landlords, and crucially, the organizations which represent the professional bodies that advise landlords and tenants, so the likes of land agents, chartered surveyors, accountants, solicitors, and the like. So hopefully we will at least have an agreed basis upon which those relationships should be taken forward. We are also looking to the government to think about introducing a tenant farming commissioner to whom complaints can be heard, or would look at how things should be developed more widely in terms of codes of practice. A commissioner of that ilk already operates in Scotland and is quite successful north of the border and has the respect of both the landlord and the tenant community. So we'll be looking for something similar in England to ensure that we have sensible, sustainable, good collegiate relationships south of the border as well.
George Dunn from the Tenant Farmers Association. A Soil Association report has set out a vision for regenerative forestry, calling for more effective integration of farming and forestry and a larger number of tree species in commercial woodland. Robin Walter, the author of Living with Trees, co-wrote the report for the Soil Association. I asked him what he means by regenerative forestry.
So regenerative forestry is a kind of, it's a complement to regenerative agriculture, where we're trying to put back more than we take. So over the centuries, certainly in forestry, we've taken more than we've put back. We've ended up with very low forest cover in Britain. That's been restored to some extent over the last 100 years. But obviously the forests we have now are quite different from what we lost. A forest which is dedicated solely to producing timber tends to deplete other indicators. So, for example, all the indicators are going down for forestry, woodland birds, insects, invertebrates, things like that. So, rather than taking more than we give, we need to actually give back more than we take. So, in forestry, this means trying to create forests that are rich in biodiversity. They're rich in carbon, both in the soil, in the standing timber, and in the harvested wood products that come out of them. And they're good for people. So the report focuses on, climate and nature and people are the main three main focuses.
I'm fascinated by that historical perspective. We tend to think of deforestation as something new, don't we? But in fact, it's been going on for a very, very long time.
Oh, yes, certainly in Britain, one tends to, the popular view is that there were forests up until, I don't know, ships were built for Nelson a couple hundred years ago. But actually, from sort of peak wildwood after the last ice age, some sort of 4,000 years ago, Actually, the Neolithic agricultural revolution took care of most of the deforestation. By the time the Romans came, there was about 20% cover. Then Oliver Rackham famously calculated about 15% cover in Doomsday. So that's 1086 AD. And since then, it's gone down to about 5% around 100 years ago. Then the Forestry Commission and other players increased that to around about 13% today. So we've certainly taken more than we've given over the millennia. We've put back quite a bit in the last 100 years, but obviously that's quite different from what we lost.
Yeah, it's interesting to understand things in that context because if we think of Britain with a much smaller population back in history, even then we were plundering those resources, but gradually our population's increased, our deforestation has continued. And although there's been some level of reversal in the last 100 years, it does raise the question of whether we can ever produce enough timber for our needs.
Well, that's a very good question. We import about 80% of our timber. We're the second or third or fourth highest importer of timber. China is way, way ahead as the first. And then there's a cluster of kind of G7 countries. I think Britain and Italy and Japan, I think, are in the next sort of cohort. Yes, we're a sort of advanced industrial economy. We use a vast amount of timber, and we don't have, I mean, we only have 30% cover, as I say, and even that is underutilized. The hardwood, so the broadleaf area is not is not widely harvested, and in some cases shouldn't be, but there's scope for more there. And the conifer resource is harvested, but there just isn't much of it. So yes, I mean, I think we should be producing more of our own, for sure.
Now, you've talked there, as you have in the report, about the need for new timber sources. Now, we're a small island. Where do you think these new plantations should go?
Well, we certainly need a sort of comprehensive land use strategy. And I noticed in the last few years, I mean, every month a new land use strategy comes out from some quarter contemplating where things should go. They often don't think about timber, actually. They well, quite rightly focus on farming. It covers 70% of the land. So that's by far the biggest nut to crack, so to speak. But yes, where is the timber going to go? Well, in the report, the Soil Association call for what they call a farmer-led tree planting revolution. Already one third of our forest cover, so that's about 1 million hectares of forest, is on what's designated agricultural land, so which includes private estates and farms. And the Soil Association have an ambition to double that. So that's another 1 million hectares. Now, of course, you don't want trees planted on, grade one, two, and three, food producing land, because, of course, all the demands on timber are also on food. Well, I mean, you'll know better than me how much of our own food we produce. And of course, in the last couple of years, we've had the invasion of Ukraine. Can we rely on global supplies of food anymore? Obviously not. Can we rely on global supplies of timber? Probably not. So we're in a whole new world of increased demand and question marks over the kind of globalized supply. Yes, so the short answer is agricultural land, but carefully selected. I mean, probably grade 3B and 4. Grade five, it tends to be peatland, which has its own characteristics and should be preserved and restored. Extremely rich in carbon, far, far richer in carbon than forests. So, one shouldn't be planting on that. I mean, a lot was back in the sort of heydays of plantation forestry. And where those forests come to maturity, actually, often it's best not to replant, but to restore it to peatland. And obviously, they have great wildlife characteristics as well.
So when you're talking about growing trees on that much more land, are you thinking about integrating woodland and food production or using separate land for food and forests?
So is it kind of either or can we integrate it to the farm landscape? Well, I'm a great fan of integrating. I think there is a case There's certainly a case for taking the least productive areas, entirely out of agriculture and putting them into productive forestry, by which I don't mean pure Sitka. Perhaps we'll come to that in a minute. And again, the Soil Association have been very vocal on integrating trees to the farm landscape in the form of agroforestry. So this is sort of trees around the margins, shelter belts, strips, all alternate strips of sort of a strip cropping of cereals interspersed with trees, as they do in France, extensively. And it's quite interesting. The Soil Association are running a project at the moment, pilot projects for well, not converting, but some applying agroforestry to farms, and they're looking out for sort of trial areas to look at. I also noticed that the Forestry Commission are recruiting 10 agroforestry officers to advise on agroforestry, in all corners of I think that's England only, actually, that one, because it's a devolved administration. So certainly there's a lot of interest. I realize that farmers are good at farming and they might not be that interested in forestry, but perhaps I'm doing them a disservice.
Now, regenerative forestry, as I understand it, has integration at its heart. But many people in the forest sector would say that the most efficient way to lock in carbon and meet domestic timber requirements is through conifer plantations. Are they wrong?
Yeah, it's complicated. It depends what you measure and at what point you measure it, and what the counterfactuals are, what land you're planting on. The report mostly talks about how to treat existing stands of timber. There is, of course, an argument for more, greater forest cover, and how would one plant, in anticipation of regeneration. And of course, diversity is really the main factor there, a mix of species. Our timber industry has tended to focus on a single output, which is high grade saw logs, well, or at least saw logs. Hopefully some of them are high grade, and so to the exclusion of people, biodiversity, all those other, well, in fact, any and even carbon, because it wasn't an issue back in the 50s. Well, I mean, it was, we just didn't know it. So these days you might be able to maximize one output timber by planting pure Sitka spruce. It grows much faster in difficult places, the difficult places it's allowed to grow, where the land isn't needed for other things. It produces by far the most timber. But as I say, all the kind of indicators are showing that focusing on one thing, is not really sustainable, and we need to up our game. And really, we need to think about what are the carbon implications, what are the biodiversity implications, what are the social implications? Because of course, conifer monocultures are not popular, and they were famously stopped up in the Flow Country. That was really the in 88. That was really the end of the kind of conifer planting boom. And since then, forestry has been trying to regain its reputation as a sort of acceptable social practice, and it's gone a long way to doing that, and hasn't really got the credit for it. But I envisage a time when people will be crying out for forestry and woodland plantations in their parish, in their valley, in their area, because they'll see how wonderful woods are.
And just finally, Robin, in your view, what are the biggest impediments and the biggest opportunities in terms of driving that change that you want to see?
I think actually just that last point I was on, it's really having a vision and a culture which will enable this. I mean, yes, we can look at sort of land strategy reports and count up the hectares of grade four land and make plans on maps. It's always easy making plans for other people's land and other people's livelihoods. And I realize, it's actually farmers on the ground who are going to, be planting and tending these trees and handing them on to future generations. So we should be mindful of that. It's really imagining a land with more trees in it. And once one has an idea that, oh yeah, this could work, If we, you know, that land over there could be a productive oak plantation. Yeah, it's going to take 100 years, but you know, we need to start now. Or you know, this huge arable field might do better with a shelter belt around it, and maybe some strips down the middle. And actually, our cattle might do better with a bit of shade and shelter. You know, all of this has had studies done about improving stock condition and diet and all those kinds of things. So it's really imagining it. Of course, there are you know, grant schemes, and I realize that's a really hot topic at the moment. The Elm scheme, is it actually going to succeed in steering farmers toward what the government think is needed? Is that really the right way? I mean, obviously, your other podcasts and interviews have covered this extensively. So that's part of a much bigger conversation about agricultural land use. But I mean, I think trees need to be a part of that, because you know, we should have. I mean, I would go far further than the government in their rather modest targets of increasing trees, and go, you know, for more like 30% cover. But then I'm a bit of a nutter on that. So, but yes, where would they go? How are they going to integrate? But first, we have to imagine it and think, yes, this is something we want. And for those forests actually to be places people want to go, want to see, you know, want to work. And I think if people want it, it'll happen. If people think, oh, it's just dark conifers owned by someone else of no benefit to local people or the owner, then you know, it's going to be an uphill struggle.
That was Robin Walter from the Soil Association, bringing us to the end of this programme. Thank you to all my guests. I hope you've enjoyed the conversations. And if you have, please take a moment to share the podcast, and do get in touch if you've got news to share. More, as ever, on our website, 8.9.com, where you can also sign up for our weekly newsletter. I've been Finlow Castain. Bye for now.